Hello, listeners. This is Carolyn Yeager, bringing you the 8th installment of my reading of the Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau, 1939-1945, a book written by Alfred de Zayas from the surviving files of this bureau. I will be reading chapters 14 and 15 in this installment, which is about 20 pages. Chapter 14 is titled The Western Theater of War. It's 12 pages long. You're going to notice that the alleged crimes in the West in the early part of the war are quite different than the beastly and savage excesses that took place in Poland. As a reminder, the successful German invasion of France and the Low Countries began on 10th May 1940, and the armistice with France was signed on the 22nd of June. France, Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg were all occupied by Germany then. So I begin. In the course of the German invasion and occupation of Belgium, Holland, and northern France, the high command of the Wehrmacht received allegations of the abuse of civilians by British and French troops and of crimes against members of the German armed forces committed by Allied soldiers and civilians. As it had done in the Polish campaign, the War Crimes Bureau sent a number of military judges to investigate and document events in the Western Theater of War. The liaison officers between the German Foreign Office and the German forces in the West similarly collected material, which the Foreign Office then used to compile a white book on violations of international law by the Western Allies. Moreover, a special propaganda company was assigned to carry out in loco investigations in the province of Zeeland. Now, in loco means in place, that would be on location. They actually went to the places. And the province of Zeeland is the southern part of the Netherlands, kind of an islandy, broken up area. So Zeeland means Sealand, actually, Sealand. And New Zealand is named after this Zeeland in the Netherlands. I think what happened is that when the Germans succeeded in taking over an area, then the people of Belgium, where they were, came forth, and most of it was in Belgium, came forth and complained or reported about these violations or crimes committed by the British troops while they were there. And that's why we have the complaints to the Germans about how the British behaved and outrages that they committed while they were in charge. All right, the first section I'll be reading is headed Allied Crimes Against Civilians. The internal correspondence of the offices involved and the investigatory procedures themselves show that there was no fabrication of atrocity stories, but rather the methodical collection and evaluation of evidence. Nor was there any attempt to blame the Allies for destruction that may have been caused by the Germans themselves. For example, one investigation of what the Germans had suspected was wanton arson by retreating Allied troops concluded, quote, "The causes of the destruction of the town of Middelburg are not altogether clear. The mayor of the town insists that the destruction of the town, including the city hall and the church," and notice the church is mentioned here, "was caused by German bombs and artillery. The allegations of the mayor are difficult to refute," unquote. Well, it may have been difficult to refute in that what they call, you know, the chaos of war. Sometimes it's hard to tell who does what, but I would say my own feeling about this is that the German pilots were always told not to bomb churches, and they always avoided that. While there can always be stray bombs, it's very questionable. In this case, I would say that it wasn't perhaps mainly the Allies who did that damage, who did that destruction. But as de Zayas is pointing out here, these War Crime Bureau judges were very, very careful. They didn't exaggerate anything. They didn't try to make unsubstantiated claims against the enemy. They would only make the claims that they had definite, clear evidence for. So he is praising the War Crimes Bureau judges, as he has done before, for the way they carried out their job. Continuing, Other investigations in the Netherlands also failed to produce evidence of Allied impropriety. Quote, consultations in The Hague, Rotterdam, and Breda rendered an entirely negative result. Plundering or other violations of international law cannot be clearly established. In the course of 3 visits in Breda and numerous conversations with mayors, police commissioners, etc., it became apparent that the French evacuation was carried out in a fashion that hardly gives rise to objection. The greater number of those persons evacuated from their homes could return after a few days. Notwithstanding a few marginal cases, stores and private homes were not plundered. The evacuation and return of the civilian population was carried out in an orderly fashion in keeping with the prevailing circumstances. Dutch Flanders was occupied by Belgian and French troops until 28 May 1940. No major battles took place in this area, and the Bureau investigations uncovered only minor theft, such as 1,212 florins were stolen in the village of Hulst on the night of 20 May 1940. The mayor of the town of Axel reported citizen claims of 4,352,093 florins and 72 whatever, and 143.54 florins, and a list of items, quote, pilfered by unknown persons, amounting to a jar containing 8 pounds of butter, 6 pounds of butter wrapped in paper, a vessel containing 4 pounds of pork lard, unquote. You can see from this how highly regarded fats were and how hard they were to come by and how people considered butter and lard very precious. Official inquiries in Belgium and northern France rendered more substantial results. In June 1940, the War Crimes Bureau commissioned one of its members, Martin Heinemann, to carry out special investigations in Louvain, Brussels, and Aix-de-Chapelle. At the same time, the Bureau sent Alphonse Waltzog to Louvain and then to France. Louvain is Belgium, where he focused primarily on the use of explosive, or dum-dum, in parentheses, ammunition by the Allies. In addition, the military commanders-in-chief in Belgium and northern France were requested to obtain the sworn deposition of witnesses through the military judges attached to their divisions. Judge Jansen, for instance, investigated reported instances of plundering in the Belgian town of Gerardsbergen, and on 20th August 1940, he took the deposition of the Belgian witness René de Klerk. Quote, on Sunday morning, 19 May 1940, around 5 o'clock, I saw English soldiers enter my house at 39 Meerst Street, where I own a store and a tobacco shop. The English soldiers took merchandise, shirts, razor blades, rings, watches, and canned goods. I was too afraid to go there to stop the plundering, since the English soldiers had set up a machine gun there and were threatening with it. I also observed that English soldiers plundered the house of my neighbor, the school director, Arthur Vandenberge. I later confirmed that the soldiers had opened trunks and boxes in both houses and stolen the contents. Unquote. On 5th December 1940, Judge Vaner took the deposition of Belgian butcher Alphonse de Smet concerning a death in the town of Okegem near Ghent. Ghent is a well-known place name, G-H-E-N-T. Quote, he said, on Saturday, 18 May 1940, the English were in Okegem, I don't know how that's pronounced, O-K-E-G-E-M, and interned some 100 to 120 persons, including women and children, in my house. Guards with bayonets were posted at both doors. I did not see Theophile de Beenhauer among the interned persons. When the English retreated, my daughter noticed that practically all the beer bottles at her restaurant had disappeared. I proceeded to look for the bottles and found a mound of freshly dug earth in a ditch on the other side of the street. Since I suspected the beer bottles were there, I cleared away the earth and found underneath the corpse of Theophile de Beinhauer. Unquote. Judge Vayner also investigated the death of the farmer Benoit Verneyen, that's a Belgian name. On 6 December 1940, Vayner took the deposition of three witnesses. On 3 February 1941, the 15-year-old son of the victim, Franz Verneyen, testified. Quote, on 18 May 1940, I was with my father cutting hay in the field. At around 3 p.m., I was with the horse a few meters away from my father, who was swinging the scythe, when suddenly three shots were fired. Immediately thereafter, I saw two English soldiers come from the area of the shots. I cannot say whether they were carrying guns with them, since I did not pay attention to that. When I saw them, they were at a distance of about 200 meters, and while they approached me, I saw that my father was lying on the ground, and that he had been hit by a bullet. The English soldiers ordered me to go home. Now, remember, this boy is 15. The soldiers ordered me to go home. Besides the two Englishmen, I did not see anyone else at the scene of the crime. Unquote. It was also reported that at Forens, also known as Vern, 8 civilians had been shot. Town Secretary Joris de Burchgrave gave a sworn deposition on 15 April 1941 before Judge Last. He said, quote, whereas the conduct of the English troops during the first days after their arrival did not give rise to any complaints, the situation changed in the evening of 29 May 1940. That night, many English soldiers entered the empty homes and shops in order to steal all sorts of beverages, particularly wine, liqueurs, cognac, whiskey, etc. The English soldiers were not hindered because most of the local population had fled, and the remaining civilians, including the mayor of the town, were not allowed on the streets. As soon as the civilian went out on the street on 29 May, he was ordered back into his home. On 30th and 31st May, the soldiers shot at civilians who went out on the street. I personally saw that in the evening hours of 29 May 1940, English soldiers threw furniture and other private property out of the windows of evacuated houses into the streets. Then they noisily piled up this furniture in order to build barricades. Doors and windows of many homes were broken, since the owners had locked them before leaving. Around 10:30 in the evening, soldiers knocked at my door. They ordered me with their revolvers to leave the house within 5 minutes. I can speak some English, so I asked them where I should go, since there were also members of my family and other persons in the house. When the soldiers could not answer my question, I demanded that an officer should come. The officer similarly insisted that we abandon the house, but he could not tell me where we should go. Thus, together with all the persons in my house, I went to the farm of a friend some 2 kilometers away from Vern. We stayed there until the first German troops arrived on 1st June 1940. About 7 or 8 in the morning of 1st June, I returned, together with a friend, to my home in Vern. Although the house door and the windows had been broken by the explosions, the interior of my house was intact. Not a single item was missing. The German troops were already in the town. On my way there, I saw the corpse of the 70-year-old retired civil servant, de Mulliner, who had been shot on Oost Street. The next day, I also saw the corpse of the laborer, Florizun, who had been shot on Staty Street. I learned from friends that both persons were shot by the English soldiers on 31st May 1940 because they were seen on the streets. Friends also told me that 6 more persons, including 2 women, were killed when they went out on the street. Wow. This was stated by the town secretary. In the town of Menen, the popular Belgian cyclist, Julian Verweke, was killed. The report of the investigation into his death, dated 22nd August 1941, describes the events as follows. Quote, in connection with their retreat, the British in Menin wanted to blow up the Leja Bridge, which connects Menin with the road to Halun and Ronk. Before that, they set up a barricade and took out the furniture from the neighboring houses, including the hotel of the Verveke family. Why do they just keep using people's furniture? Verveke left the air raid shelter on 24th May 1940 and went to his home to get food for his family. This is the bicyclist, Verveke. In so doing, he came across the English troops who were taking furniture out of his house. Knowing Verveke's impulsive character, it is probable that he protested. The situation may have been aggravated by the fact that Verveke could not speak any English and did not speak French very well. Verveke was arrested by the English soldiers and taken to the Parc Torres in Ronk, where he was shot. The events are confirmed by witness testimony. In view of the war operations, it is at first understandable that British troops arrested Verveke when he opposed their use of his furniture for building barricades, but further measures taken by the British soldiers against Verveke were brutal and a gross violation of international law, unquote. The Bureau also investigated cases in which French troops were involved. The most important appears to have been the shooting of some 21 prisoners in Abbeville on 20th May 1940. Some of them were Belgian nationalists and fascists, but others were Jewish refugees from Germany, who, ironically, had been arrested upon the outbreak of the war. In parentheses, the War Crimes Bureau itself was apparently not involved in the Abbeville investigations, but only received copies of the inquiry from the liaison officer of the German Foreign Office at the High Command of the Fourth Army, Consul General Schattenfroh. The most significant testimony is that of Paul Winter, a Danish engineer who had also been detained by the French and who managed to escape during a German air attack. 21 corpses were found at the place where Winter claimed that the executions had taken place, and his testimony was used in a German Foreign Office propaganda brochure titled The Crimes of Lille and Abbeville. Testimony was also obtained from the Belgian journalist Achiel Mariel, who together with 51 other prisoners had been transferred from Abbeville to Rouen. He was separated from the others, however, so that he was not a direct witness of the killings. Long before the Bureau completed its own investigations with regard to the Western Theater, the German Foreign Office published Documents of British-French Cruelty, The War Conduct of Britain and France in the Netherlands, Belgium, and Northern France in May 1940. That's the title of that publication. This 1940 white book contains primarily reports of war crimes allegedly committed by the Allies against civilians in the areas under military occupation. The statements are not supported by judicial investigations, however, and the accuracy of some is clearly open to question. Yet it is fairly certain that a number of the violations described did take place. Internal documents not intended for publication attest to the German conviction that the Allied troops did, in fact, commit a variety of crimes. For instance, the report of the Commander-in-Chief for Belgium and Northern France, dated 5th December 1940, reads in part, quote, "It has been established that violations of international law were committed both by French and by British soldiers and officers. These violations include the killing of civilian persons, deliberate shooting at and threatening of civilians, destruction of buildings through arson and bombardment, devastation of the interior of private homes, and plundering," unquote. The next section is headed Crimes Against German Soldiers in France. From the available Bureau records, it appears that investigations of crimes committed by Allied soldiers and civilians against members of the German armed forces were far more extensive in France than in Holland and Belgium. A typical report is that of non-commissioned officer Karl Michaelis, who on 9 June 1940 was wounded in a village near Le Havre. On 6 September 1940, Bureau member Karl Hoffmann took his deposition at Military Hospital in New Brandenburg, where Michaelis was convalescing. He said, quote, "In the course of the battle, I received 2 superficial wounds in my left lower and upper arm, and then a bullet through my right upper arm. Gradually, our ammunition ran out, so that we had no choice but to surrender to the British. Because of my wounds, I was unable to continue fighting and lay on the ground. Together with me were Corporal Magdans and a reserve soldier who was superficially wounded. Since we had become defenseless, my 5 men put away their rifles and stood next to the barn. At that moment, the British came from behind the barn, some 15 to 20 men. I know for a fact that my men had their arms up and that none of them had any weapon when the British soldiers arrived. Without speaking a word, the British aimed at my comrades and shot them, although none of my comrades had made any aggressive move. On the contrary, and I must repeat this, my comrades were standing with their arms raised. In the shooting, I myself received another superficial wound in the neck. The 3 reserve soldiers and Corporal Leibner were dead on the spot. Corporal Magdans passed away some 10 minutes later. After the shooting, the English came up to us and turned the bodies around, including me, and even kicked the corpses, apparently to see whether we were still alive. I myself cried out because I experienced great pain in my arm when they grabbed me. One of the English soldiers, who, like the others, was very close to me, aimed his rifle at me. At this moment, an English sergeant suddenly came from behind the barn and vigorously shouted at the other soldiers. Through his intervention, I was spared. This British sergeant, who was himself wounded, stayed with me for the duration of the battle and also dressed my wounds." Unquote. This tells us that the common English soldier, when his leadership is missing, will carry out atrocities and war crimes without any compunction. But their hatred for the Germans was drilled into them. Continuing, although there are relatively few reports of British war crimes in the field, the Bureau incorporated a selection of them into an unpublished document titled Violations of the Laws of War by the British Armed Forces. Many of the depositions obtained concerned the ill-treatment or lynching of German air crews following an emergency landing or parachuting in France. On 11 October 1940, Lieutenant Rudolf Gaude testified before Judge Ufer that on 16th June, as he and Sergeant Herrig, quote, "were still in the air, we jumped out at an altitude of about 1,500 meters. 2 French Marines repeatedly circled around us and shot at us. I was not hit, but Sergeant Herrig was probably killed in the air during the second attack. I found him the next morning some 1,000 meters away from the place where I had landed. He was dead, and one leg had been completely shot off. I had seen when he was still in the air that he threw back his arms and his head. There is no doubt that this wound was brought about by a direct hit from the airplane's cannon." Unquote. Another case concerned non-commissioned officer Karl Fritz Vollner, who on 14th May 1940 had to jump out of his airplane over Sedan at an altitude of 3,500 meters. On 23rd September 1940, he was summoned to testify before Judge Schmittel in Saxony. He stated under oath that at an altitude of above 500 meters, he was hit in the upper thigh by machine gun fire from French ground troops. French civilians, too, participated in the machine gunning of disabled airmen parachuting to the ground. Because this widespread practice frequently led to the accidental killing of British and French as well as German airmen, it became necessary to issue orders against such indiscriminate attacks. For instance, Abbeville headquarters were instructed on 15 May 1940 to shoot only at groups of at least 3 parachutists. German airmen making emergency landings on French ground had considerable difficulty in surrendering and were frequently subjected to continued fire. Sergeant Joseph Schweiger stated under oath before Judge Kommert in Esslingen am Neckar. He said, quote, After we landed, we immediately abandoned the plane. First the radio man, non-commissioned officer Anshau, then the mechanic, Sergeant Zimmer, then the observer, Corporal Hoff, and finally I as pilot. All this time we were the targets of some 150 to 200 French soldiers at a distance of 40 to 50 meters. Corporal Hoff was shot through the left thigh while lying next to the plane on the ground. I was hit in the right thigh. We were promptly encircled by the French soldiers. We raised our arms to show that we wanted to surrender. In spite of this, they continued shooting at us, shouting and yelling madly. Each of us was beaten with rifle butts. I also saw when they hit Hawk, who was lying next to me. While I was prostrate on the ground, I received a blow on my head and momentarily lost consciousness. Later on, I developed a big lump on the right side of my head. I also received rifle blows and kicks from all sides, all over my body. Unquote. On 5th June 1940, Sergeant Hans Belis landed near Corbigny, Auxerre, that's in France. His deposition was taken on 4th September 1940 by Judge Gerhard Schult of the Gießen Court. He said, quote, "I myself had been hit by a ricochet in one of my upper ribs. Two other members of the crew were also wounded. Since I speak French, I went up to the farmers working in the fields in order to ask them to obtain medical assistance for my comrades. Although I had thrown away my gun and the farmers who were coming toward me saw this, they were about 25 civilians with hunting and infantry rifles. They took aim at me, whereupon I stood still and told them what I wanted. After they promised to help, I went back to my comrades, who were hiding in bushes close to the burning aircraft. As I started to walk back, one of the civilians shot at me, at a distance of about 10 meters. The huntsman twice fired his shotgun. At least 28 pellets had to be removed from my entire body. French police eventually arrived and took us into custody." Unquote. German infantry soldiers also found it difficult to surrender, and some were killed in the attempt. Corporal Kurt Biegen stated under oath on 15th October 1940, quote, "Our cannon was out of operation and we had to surrender because we ran out of ammunition. Upon Lieutenant Frank's order, we put down our rifles and took off our belts, stood up and raised our arms to show that we were surrendering. Behind us, there were already a number of French infantry soldiers, who discussed among themselves for a moment and then opened fire on us. Lieutenant Frank and Corporal Palland were killed. There were also several dead and wounded among our infantrymen. The French soldiers then ordered us with sign language to move back. We still had our arms raised. A French soldier, it may have been a sergeant, stood in the tower of an armored vehicle and shot at us with a pistol. Trutta was first hit in the stomach, and he fell to the ground. Since he was not dead, the Frenchman opened his magazine at him. He was hit by almost every bullet and died immediately. The French soldier then ordered me to lie down, but when I saw that he started loading his weapon again, I stood up and retreated with my hands up. The Frenchman shot at me several times but did not hit me." Unquote. On 25 September 1940, Corporal Wilhelm Ermlich told his story under oath before Judge Schorn. Quote, "The French soldiers started searching the fields right and left of the road. Non-commissioned Officer Hartman ordered us to stand up without our weapons. We did this and raised our arms to indicate that we were surrendering. Some 7 Frenchmen came up to us. The rest of them, about 70 men, stayed on the road about 20 meters away. By comparison, we were only 1 non-commissioned officer and 4 men. Suddenly, another Frenchman from the road came down to us, pushed his comrades away, and closely observed us. He then yelled, 'Captain!' 4 times in the belief that Hartman was an officer. At this point, the Frenchman who had first come up to us opened fire at very short distance, although we still had our hands up and did not make any move that could have been interpreted as resistance or an attempt to escape. When I saw that Corporal Pfeiffer, who stood at our extreme left, got a bullet in his forehead, I let myself drop to the ground. The next moment, Hartman and Corporal Tittman, both of them wounded, fell over me. Private Stahn, who was standing a bit farther away, was probably hit at about the same moment. I then heard the Frenchmen reload their guns and fire 5 shots at us on the ground. This time I was hit in the thigh, but I did not move so as not to show that I was still alive. The Frenchmen then left. I cannot say what regiment they belonged to. Unquote. The German campaign in the West had started on 10th May and ended on 22nd June 1940 with the signing of the French armistice. For this period of 6 weeks, the War Crimes Bureau obtained the depositions of several hundred witnesses, many of them German soldiers who were liberated from French captivity after the armistice. Some 400 of these sworn statements were printed in 2 special reports prepared for internal use by the Bureau, one in September 1940 and another in April 1941. The first dealt with French breaches of the Geneva Convention on the Treatment of Prisoners of War, classified as extortion of information on military secrets, killing of defenseless wounded soldiers, attacks on airmen after forced landings, ill treatment, shackling, bad conditions of detention, inadequate rations, compulsion to perform military assignments, and confiscation of private property. The second divided violations of the Geneva Convention for the amelioration of the condition of the wounded and sick into breaches against the Red Cross, misuse of the Red Cross, and inadequate medical attention. For political reasons, in order not to counter the official policy of reaching an entente with France, these 2 reports were distributed only to a very limited circle, with specific instructions that their content was not to be published, copied, or given to persons or agencies outside the Wehrmacht, except those copies made available to the German Foreign Office, which, however, never published any part of them. The next section is headed The French Resistance. The War Crimes Bureau files are very incomplete with regard to possible violations of the laws of war by members of the French Resistance, which is officially named Forces Françaises de l'Intérieur, or FFI, by members of the French Resistance in the years 1941-44, or for that matter, concerning violations committed by regular French forces following the Allied Normandy invasion and subsequent liberation of French territory from German occupation. But a few documents remain. So what that paragraph was saying was that the files about the French Resistance organization are very incomplete, but they have a few documents to go by. One of the most important cases concerned the fate of German POWs who had been taken prisoner in the Haute Savoie in August 1944 and whom the FFI threatened to execute if the German government refused to grant the FFI combatant status and POW rights in captivity. This was the outrageous demand of the French Resistance that they be recognized by the Germans as a legitimate military part of France. And the Germans refused to do that, and they had no right to make such a demand, but they said if they didn't get what they wanted, they were going to execute Germans that they had captured, and they did. So it goes on to say, when Berlin declined to answer the ultimatum, 80 German prisoners were executed by the FFI near Annecy on 2nd September 1944. The Bureau obtained confirmation of the killings by questioning some returning prisoners who were exchanged for wounded and sick French prisoners. Depositions were obtained, for instance, from Private Rudolf Diepold and Sergeant Georg Fackler. Following the German television broadcast of the War Crimes Bureau documentary in 1983, several additional witnesses identified themselves and forwarded their testimony. One such witness was Anton Gottschaller, who had been taken prisoner by the FFI in Annecy on 19 August 1944, and who had described the events in an affidavit dated 4 February 1954. Concerning the victims from the Annecy POW camp, Gottschaller stated, quote, it's a fairly long statement. In the early hours of this Saturday, 34 persons were called out alphabetically by name. One of those was called Fritz Lössel, a medical orderly for many years, who was wearing his Red Cross armband. This fact caused a certain hesitation on the part of the Frenchmen, who consulted among themselves for a while. But finally, Lössel remained on the list. The 34 men were then led away. Sometime later, 9 other prisoners and I were assigned to a work detail. We were led in a rush toward Sacconge. At this place, we received 5 picks and 5 shovels. About 1 kilometer beyond Sacconge, we saw a truck out of which our comrades, who had been led away earlier in the morning, were descending. There was an exchange of words between 2 clergymen who apparently had also come in the truck, Lutheran pastor Hochstetter and Catholic priest Fritz Volker, and the French commander, Major Barillet. From their agitated tone, I assumed that our comrades were to be shot. Barillet stated that it was irrelevant whether the persons had themselves committed any offense. Quote, you all cried out, Heil Hitler, and now you will pay for it. Unquote. Preparations for the executions were made, and the first group was taken away. Thereupon I heard wild shooting in all directions. Some men of this first group attempted to escape without success. Together with the work group, I had to collect the bodies. There were 10 bodies. We were then ordered to dig a mass grave in the fallow land nearby. We were not allowed to look up, but from a distance of some 20 meters, I saw that 3 further groups of 10 men each were executed. That is 40 men in all. 6 officers had been added to the 34 men who had been picked up in the morning. The dead were then buried in the grave. Unquote. 40 other German POWs from the camp at Saint-Pierre-de-Vermilly were executed the same day at Haber-Lulin. Although Gottschaller was not a direct witness, he personally knew some of the victims, and his 1954 affidavit includes what he was able to find out, both during his captivity and in a more thorough investigation after his release in 1947. He said, quote, the execution detachment from Annecy also went on 2nd September 1944 to the camp at Saint-Pierre-de-Vermilly, some 30 kilometers northwest of Annecy. In the afternoon of that day, 40 prisoners of war were called by name. Some of them were not there because they had been assigned to a work company outside. The missing places were filled arbitrarily. Some persons volunteered, Dietsch and Hoffmann, thinking that they were being assigned to another work company. This also explains why 2 Austrians are on the list of dead, who from the French side would certainly not have been selected for execution. These 40 men were executed on the same afternoon at Haber-Lulin. 5 wooden posts were set up, and the men were shot 5 at a time. The next group of 5 was required to carry the bodies of their dead comrades. A Catholic priest, Frenchman, was present. A woman had intended to beat the men with a bat, but she was prevented from doing so. In the same evening, the 40 bodies were returned in coffins. On Monday, 2 days later, they were buried. On Sunday, a representative of the International Committee of the Red Cross had come by auto and made photographs of the coffins. We were informed of this execution by the French. The details of the killings were given to me on 23rd July 1947 by a camp comrade, the Lutheran pastor Hermann Blanke. On this day, he also spoke with 2 witnesses of the execution, a teacher from Haber-Lulin, M. Durey, and an old farmer whose farm is across from the field where the executions took place. Both described the events in concurring fashion. Here I think we see another example of what we hear about in the Holocaust, the so-called Holocaust, where we have here the French taking, selecting certain number of their prisoners for execution, and then selecting other prisoners to come along and bury them. this, like the Sonderkommandos. This, to me, is an exact duplicate of how they then accused the Germans of carrying these things out. Because of what they did and how they think, they used that against the Germans. This is another example of that. Continuing on, it is a sad arabesque to these killings that the Reich government subsequently did agree to provide nominal roles of FFI members, that is French Resistance, held prisoner in Germany, and gave verbal assurance to the International Committee of the Red Cross that members of the FFI taken by the Germans would be treated as prisoners of war. So this was the French Resistance who was executing these captured Germans that they had. But this is very likely where the idea came to them to accuse the Germans of executing people and having Sonderkommandos to deal with the disposal of their bodies in the camps. I think it's very likely this is exactly where this came from. The French Resistance was largely Jewish, and it was extremely anti-Nazi, fanatically so. And it was criminal-minded, totally criminal-minded, and they were outside of the law. The whole story of the French Resistance is a big lie for the most part, and the British and the Americans had no business dealing with them and even helping them and supporting them materially, but they did it, and yet today they're still not held to account for that. It's one huge war crime. That's what it is. That was the end of chapter 14. And I'm now going on to chapter 15, which is titled simply Crete. The German invasion of the island of Crete in the Mediterranean commenced in the morning of 20th May 1941. After heavy fighting, the British, Australian, and New Zealand troops were evacuated on 31st May. In those 4 days, great losses were suffered on both sides. Some 4,000 British soldiers and sailors were killed, 12,000 taken prisoner, and 18,000 evacuated. It is estimated that 4,000 German soldiers and sailors perished. The involvement of the Cretan population as irregular soldiers contributed to the substantial battle losses and later gave the Germans an excuse to carry out draconian reprisals. See, he calls it, Josias calls it an excuse. But that's the kind of language he uses. And I want to make a comment here about Crete from another source, that throughout the Battle of Crete, the Allied forces and Cretan irregulars had inflicted heavy losses of lives on the Wehrmacht, in particular the unprecedented resistance from the local population. Unprecedented resistance from the local population exasperated the Prussian sense of military order, according to which no one but professional warriors should be allowed to fight. Well, that was not just the Prussian sense of military order, but that was the laws of war of the Hague and Geneva Conventions. Continuing, reports from General Julius Ringel, commander of the 5th Mountain Division, stated that Cretan civilians were picking off paratroopers or attacking them with knives, axes, and scythes. Even before the end of the battle, stories had started to circulate attributing the excessively high casualties to torture and mutilation of paratroopers by the Cretans. When these stories reached the Luftwaffe's high command in Berlin, Göring commanded General Kurt Student to undertake inquiries and reprisals. Well, then what else was there to do? That is what you do in cases like this. That's what's done, and everybody understands it. Everybody does it. And they all understand that it's going to be done. So continuing with chapter 15, during the first days of the fighting, an unusually high number of violations of the law were reported. The first sworn depositions were taken on the island on 26 May. Now that's just 6 days after the beginning of the invasion of Crete. In all, some 150 witnesses were questioned by 12 German Army, Navy, and Air Force judges. Although the depositions continued all through the summer, at least until 25th August 1941, the War Crimes Bureau completed in July a long study titled Enemy Violations of International Law During the German Engagement in Crete, which evaluated the extensive documentation already collected. The study comprises chapters dealing with killings and mutilations, misuse of the German flag and German uniforms, Franc-Tireur activity, and remember, Franc-Tireur actually means free shooter. It's French for free shooter, meaning civilians who take up arms and go around fighting against the enemy without being in a uniform or without being part of the army. And attacks on German transport by sea and the killing of German shipwrecked survivors. The Bureau forwarded this study to the German Foreign Office, which used substantial parts of it in an official white book titled Violations of International Law by British Armed Forces and by Civilians in Crete, which was published and distributed in 1942. This first section is headed Official Reports. Quite valuable to the Bureau in preparing the study were not only the depositions themselves, but the reports submitted by Army Judge Joachim Schultz, Air Force Judge Roland Rudel, and Medical Officer Dr. Helmut Unger. Judge Schultz had had considerable experience in questioning witnesses and victims in Poland, following which he had continued working in the legal department of the Wehrmacht in Berlin. Called upon again to carry out investigations on the spot, he flew to Athens and then to Crete, where he interrogated 32 witnesses between 26 May and 4 June 1941. His report of 4 June summed up his impressions. This is Judge Schultz. He said, quote, "The content of the sworn depositions is complemented and confirmed by the statements that officers and men have given on the basis of their own experience and on reports of third parties. Through the sworn depositions, the following violations of international law are established without doubt. 1. Many parachutists were subjected to inhuman treatment or mutilated. 2. During the battle around Suda Bay on 27 May 1941, the 1st Mountain Infantry Regiment No. 141 had to retreat temporarily to a better position because of enemy superiority and on account of the difficult terrain. A, there's A and B here, A, all wounded who could not be transported were murdered. B, many of the corpses found the next day had been mutilated. Number 3, warships of the Royal Navy attacked German shipwrecked soldiers whose transport ships had been sunk some 100 kilometers from Crete and who were drifting helplessly in the water. 4, British soldiers misused the German swastika flag, parts of German uniforms, and the white flag. 5, civilians participated in the fighting as Franc-Tireurs. According to the sworn testimony of witnesses who confirmed and complimented one another, there is the following evidence that the wounded left behind were murdered. Scouting patrols that returned to the battlefield 1 or 2 hours after the fight and burial detail sent the following day found 124 dead and not a single man wounded. A corporal who had a shot only in the shoulder lay there with his own knife in his throat. Oh, boy. Many of the dead had, in addition to other injuries, stab wounds or shots through the head or through the heart. The number of shots through the head and heart was remarkably high, although the battalion had been attacked primarily with machine guns. 2 of the dead had serious stab wounds that had not issued any blood. Before withdrawing, the enemy must have dealt each German soldier, whether dead or alive, a lethal stab or bullet wound to make sure that no living remained behind. I believe that the British and the Greek soldiers, as well as the civilian population, may all be guilty. The British took prisoners at first and probably treated them well. After the fall of Chania, the Germans pursued them, and this made it difficult for them to transport or feed the prisoners. It is possible that they then tended not to take prisoners and thus did not spare the wounded men. In my opinion, Greek soldiers and civilians are also suspect. It is necessary to investigate the events thoroughly before we can determine the extent to which Greek soldiers were guilty of maltreating and mutilating members of the German armed forces, such as the parachutists." Unquote. Judge Rudel In charge of investigating allegations about crimes committed against parachutists, First questioned numerous wounded soldiers who had been flown to hospitals in Athens. Their testimony convinced the Chief of Staff of the 11th Air Corps, Major General Alfred Schlemm, that a special commission under Intelligence Officer Major Johannes Bach should be sent forthwith to Crete to continue on-site investigations. Riedel, as a member of the commission, flew to Crete on 28th May 1941. On 14 July, he submitted a long report more favorable to the British military than to the Cretan civilian population. He summed up, quote, on the basis of sworn testimony of German soldiers who participated in the fighting on Crete, plus interrogation of Greek and British soldiers, and aided by photographic evidence, we could establish the following. 1. Participation of civilians and policemen in open battle on all battlefields, especially in the western part of the island. Just think about that. Civilians and police. You know, regular police. In some areas, civilians offered organized resistance according to military principles. The civilian population, including youngsters about 10 years old, fired with all sorts of weapons, also with dum-dum and hunting ammunition. Bush and tree snipers were repeatedly observed. 2. Dead and wounded soldiers were robbed and deprived of parts of their clothing, primarily by the civilian population. 3. On corpses of German soldiers, countless mutilations have been established. Some had their genitals amputated, eyes put out, ears and noses cut off. Others had knife wounds in the face, chest, stomach, and back. Throats were slit and hands chopped off. Well, this is like in Poland now, the same kind of bestiality and fanaticism of the irregular fighters who jumped in, or civilians. The majority of these mutilations were probably defilement of the dead bodies. Only in a few cases does the evidence indicate that the victim was maltreated and tortured to death. A number of corpses were found with hands, arms, or legs tied up. In one case, the corpse had a cord around his neck. 4. On the enemy side, the use of German uniforms, especially parachutist combinations and steel helmets, was observed. Similarly, in order to deceive the other side, they signaled with swastika flags. 5. Shipwrecked soldiers in the Light Squadron West, which had been attacked and partly destroyed by British warships in the night of the 21st-22nd May, were shot at by the British. Soldiers swimming in the water with life vests or paddling their lifeboats were fired upon, and many killed or wounded. From these investigations, it appears that the mutilation of corpses and the maltreatment of soldiers were committed almost exclusively by Cretan civilians. In some cases, survivors observed that civilians fell upon dead soldiers, robbed them, and cut them up with knives. In only one case were enemy soldiers involved in such acts. On the contrary, the British attached great importance to the proper treatment of prisoners of war, prevented abuses by Greek soldiers and civilians, and did all that was necessary in the medical field. On the other hand, the shooting of shipwrecked was carried out exclusively by British warships. It is difficult to determine how it was that the civilian population of Crete participated in the fighting and committed atrocities. The statements made by the Cretans and by the British prisoners must be taken cum grano salis, or with a grain of salt, because they each tend to put the blame on the other. Unquote. That was Riedel. On the question of mutilations, Dr. Helmut Unger was called upon to evaluate the evidence. In a memorandum dated 19 June 1941 to Air Force Medical Inspector Hipke, Unger reported, number 1, the head medical officer at the Air Force Hospital in Saloniki knows of only one case of stab wounds, and this was a soldier who had numerous stab wounds in the throat, chest, and stomach. A woman is said to have inflicted the wounds. Number 2, in the hospital at Athens, there was supposed to be a large number of mutilated soldiers, yet upon questioning the doctors there, we could not find a single case, The doctors knew in general that mutilations had taken place in Crete, but the mutilated had already died on the island. 3. On Crete itself, at Chania, I received the first authentic statement through medical officer Dr. W. Roderwig, who himself had seen the mutilations and immediately photographed them. There were mutilated corpses from the Battle of Castelcicano. It is reported that of the 57 parachutists who had landed there, 40 had been mutilated by stab wounds in the throat, chest, stomach, by amputation of the testicles, or by putting out the eyes. The entire material on these cases was given to intelligence officer Captain Moores. The remaining 17 men were spared such treatment because they were able to entrench themselves in a prison. As reprisal for these atrocities, Dr. Roderwig stated that 200 male residents of Castelcicano had been shot. Judge Rudel later commented on the statements of Dr. Roderwig that the numbers given were too high. He was not able to give me more precise information at the time because the entire documentation had already been sent to Reichsmarshal Göring. Judge Rudel summed up that according to his depositions, 6 to 8 cases had been established by the Salvage Corps in Castelcicano. In other towns, 15 other cases. Near Rethymnon, 3 or 4 cases together. It could not be determined whether the mutilations were inflicted on the still living or only on the dead. None of the mutilated still lives. All explanations given on questioning indicate that no enemy soldiers were involved in the mutilations or defilement of corpses. Bestialities are attributable exclusively to fanatical civilians. The fair fighting methods of the British and the New Zealanders were also duly noted by Judge Rudel. There you see the difference in nationality and the sub-races of Europe. That was my comment. Number 4. On my flight back from Athens to Berlin, I had the opportunity of speaking with 2 gravely wounded soldiers who had participated in the battle near Rethymnon. They were Corporal Harry Kurtz and Sergeant Rudolf Greve. Both soldiers stated that they were eyewitnesses of cases of torture and mutilation committed against German parachutists near Rethymnon and that they were prepared to give further information thereon. All right, the next section is headed Eyewitness Reports. Concurrent with these sober investigations of what actually happened in Crete, the German press launched a virulent campaign against the fighting methods of the British Army and of the Cretan population, exaggerating both the number of the victims and the nature of the mutilations. Probably, a considerable percentage of alleged cases of mutilation did not entail deliberate torture, but resulted from hand-to-hand combat. The unusually high number of reports concerning the loss of eyes could similarly be explained in many cases by the mere fact that the corpses were found after decomposition had begun in the Mediterranean heat of late May. Oh, sure. Still, some reports came from soldiers who were aware of this possibility. In a statement to Judge Oscar von Jagowitz on 29 July 1941, Corporal Friedrich Meyer asserted that, quote, in the case of the body of the German parachutist lying on his back, I could clearly establish that his nose and both ears had been cut off and the eyes poked out. I observed this quite carefully. Such changes on the face could not be the result of decomposition, since the corpse was at most 1 day old. Moreover, a number of German soldiers stated under oath that they saw mutilations being carried out. On 11 June 1941, Judge Schultz obtained the following deposition from Corporal Erich Fiedler. Quote, on 20th May 1941, shortly after we landed with our parachutes, we were taken prisoner by British soldiers, Greek soldiers, and the civilians in the vicinity of Castelli. I myself was wounded and lay under the body of a dead German sergeant. A civilian rolled over the body of the sergeant, took a knife out, and stabbed him repeatedly. I saw with my own eyes how he cut the sergeant's eyes out. Once he missed, but then he struck in the middle of the eye, turned his knife 2 or 3 times inside the socket, and pulled it out. Then he did the same with the other eye. And these are such heroic, you know, when they want to tell us about how heroic the Greeks are and what great fighters they are, well, this is what half of it was all about. Only a limited number of mutilations could be subjected to forensic medical examination. One doctor called upon to examine suspicious injuries was Helmut Zanker, who stated in his deposition of 11 June 1941 before Judge Schultz, "In a number of cases, the ears had been cut off. I also established cuts and gashes in the area of the nose. Both eyes of a soldier, I believe a lieutenant, had been put out. The eye sockets were completely empty, and the edges had crusts of clotted blood. I have no doubt whatever that the stab wounds were inflicted after the men had fallen into enemy hands. The wounds were all in the same area of the chest or of the throat, so that it is impossible that they would have been inflicted in exactly this fashion during combat." Unquote. Since the German press was accusing British troops of committing atrocities, British General Bernard Freiberg ordered an investigation. The results, published in July of 1941, rejected all German accusations as unfounded, naturally. Nevertheless, the records of the War Crimes Bureau do contain a number of sworn statements by German soldiers who claimed to have witnessed violations of the law of war by British soldiers. Corporal Martin Prem testified before Judge Rudel, quote, "Shortly after jumping over Crete on 20 May 1941, that was the first day, I came upon 4 wounded comrades who were attempting to bandage each other. In order to have better cover, I moved down to a ditch near the 4 men. From there, I observed that 3 Cretan civilians with bayonets and a British soldier, also with a bayonet, stabbed the wounded soldiers repeatedly with the bayonets for about 5 to 10 minutes. The comrades cried out in pain. The British soldier, who had just been observing the Cretans doing that, took out a grenade and placed it in the middle of the German wounded and rushed away with the Cretans. After the grenade exploded, the 4 men continued moaning until dark. I could not assist them while they were being attacked because I myself was out of ammunition. Of the 4 dead, I knew Corporal Freitag and Private Martin, both of the 10th Storm Regiment. The crying and moaning ceased after I heard some shots in the area. I assume that the 4 were finished off by a British patrol." Unquote. Now that's torture. That's pure torture. They stabbed these soldiers with bayonets, not in a way to kill them, but to just hurt them. For 5 to 10 minutes, he said, while they were crying out in pain. Wow. Well, on 27 May 1941, Corporal Rudolf Dahlenberg gave the following deposition to Judge von Jagwitz, and he said, quote, "A comrade of another company, whom I did not know by name, was wounded in the chest. He lay some 70 meters away from me. I could clearly observe that he was alive. Suddenly a New Zealand soldier rose and went up to the comrade, who remained lying on the ground and moaning. The New Zealander took the German's rifle away and smashed his head with the butt." Unquote. On 31st May 1941, a soldier named Rudolf Bachmann stated before Judge Steiner, quote, "I lay in a vineyard and was taken prisoner by the British. For a distance of 60 to 70 meters, I saw that 8 to 10 British soldiers were occupied with a wounded German parachutist in a ditch. They removed his uniform. When the wounded soldier lay on the ground, a British soldier shot him with his pistol at short distance." Unquote. On 28th May 1941, Judge Reinecke took the deposition of Corporal Hans Bruck. He said, quote, "The British soldiers followed us and took Corporal H prisoner. I succeeded in hiding so that they did not find me. At a distance of 3 to 4 meters, I saw them press him to the ground and then shoot him in the mouth with a pistol." Unquote. On the same day, Judge Reinecke also obtained a deposition from Corporal Wilhelm Noh, N-O-H. Quote, I observed from a distance of some 30 meters that a wounded parachutist cried out for help. Thereupon, a British soldier wearing a British helmet came up to the wounded soldier, shot, and killed him, unquote. From this brief selection of sworn eyewitness accounts, and obviously then there are more, this is a small selection, it is apparent that at least some British soldiers did commit war crimes on Crete. Still, it is not necessarily surprising that the British investigation in July did not confirm the German allegations, since many of the perpetrators themselves probably fell in battle or were taken prisoner by the Germans. Nor is it probable that the British, Australian, and New Zealand soldiers who did manage to escape from Crete would have accused themselves of war crimes. That's the real biggest reason. They're not going to accuse themselves. Moreover, at the time of General Freyberg's, and now he's a British general, so maybe he pronounces it Freyberg, General Freyberg's inquiry, the German depositions had not yet been communicated to the British government. Precise information as to time, location, or the regiment involved in specific cases was not made available until the publication of the German White Book in 1942. The White Book is silent, however, on the draconian measures of reprisal taken by the Germans on Crete. As early as 31st May 1941, the German commander-in-chief ordered reprisals, without, of course, any prior judicial determination of guilt of the persons executed. Well, that's not the way you do it in a reprisal. It's not about a court and a jury and finding somebody guilty. So he goes on to end this. Göring, upon receiving copies of depositions concerning the killing and mutilation of parachutists, ordered that these crimes should be punished. As a result, the villages of Skynes, Process and Kandamos were destroyed, and the male population executed. Except that this last information comes from a book by a British author named Michael Llewellyn Smith, titled The Great Island, A Study of Crete, and I'm not able to find a single word about it on the internet. So I don't think this was very much taken note of. That is the end of Chapter 15 on Crete. To give a little background to this, according to one source, reprisal is a legal term in international humanitarian law describing a particular kind of retaliation. To be a reprisal, it must be undertaken for the purpose of forcing or inducing enemy forces to cease their own violation of international law. It is a self-enforcement of the laws of war, a self-enforcement. For reprisal is undertaken not in retaliation or punishment, but rather to force the other side to stop its violation. From that, we know that a whole lot of killing that was done by the Allies was not legal reprisal. It was war crimes. So when the Germans carried out reprisals against the French resistance or against villages, it was to force the villagers to stop violating the laws of war as they were doing. And unfortunately, a beastly level of atrocities play a big part in this war, as we found in Poland, now in Crete, and we're also going to see this in the Soviet Union in the next chapter, which I'll be reading next time, chapter 16, titled Captured Germans in the Soviet Union. So until then, this is Carolyn Yeager, and I have been reading chapter 14 and 15, in Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau, 1939 to 1945, by Alfred Desaias. See you next time.